Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. This is Lana. Quick announcement, we will be live streaming the final presidential debate tomorrow, Wednesday the 19th, starting at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time with special guests. We'll be counting score live during the debate. It'll be a fun night, so don't miss it. Head over to redice.tv or our Red Ice YouTube channel to watch live. If you downloaded this interview as an audio file, know that it's also available in video format too. This will be an interesting talk, one that incorporates a fantasy novel with Nietzschean parallels, ideas that are very relevant to the alt-right. With me is Seth Cooper, author of The Glorious Path, along with publisher-illustrator Eric Yundt. Seth Cooper is a lifelong devotee of fantasy and mythology, having earned a philosophy degree in 2001. He lives by himself in the rural northern neck of Virginia, where he continues to realize the far-reaching series that begins with The Glorious Path, his debut novel. And Eric Yundt received an education at the MD Institute College of Art, going on to work in various realms of video production. He became increasingly disgruntled with the shallowness of mainstream storytelling and created Oerstra Works as a platform to reignite sublime ideals. We'll focus on the premise the gods have fled and the dire need for the Übermensch or the Overman. Seth Cooper and Eric Yundt up next. Welcome, Seth Cooper. Thanks for coming to the program.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you very much. I don't exaggerate when I say I do take this as a high honor to have been invited onto your show. Especially since I'm somebody you've never met before and whose work you're completely unfamiliar with.
This will be fun. I'm looking forward to it. And we also have Eric Yundt. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So how did you two connect?
We first met through some mutual friends. It was about the time that I was graduating high school. And a friend I had known in high school met Seth's younger brother. And we all got together. We were having sort of like treks through the woods and playing D&D. We played some video games now and then. But it was a series of common interests that kept us as a group of friends together. Mostly dealing with, honestly, the central ideology was based around Tolkien's works. So we would often relate things like experiences, say if we're, you know, just walking through the woods, having a campfire, talking about how things that we were doing was something similar to what you might find in, say, the Silmarillion or, you know, so we started envisioning like ideas about worlds, even that far back, which was maybe something like 12 years ago. So that was in Carroll County, which is a rural county in Maryland, and it was preserved from, at least back then, it was a very hilly country preserved from, say, a large degree of deforestation and such. But it was a long running relationship that we've, you know, maintained over the years, so.
And then, Seth, of course, you're the author of The Glorious Path here, about 600 pages. It's an epic.
It's a doorstopper.
It's full of adventure and old world concepts, and we'll get into some of these things. But what inspired you to write this book?
Wow. I'm not even sure which angle to address that question from, but I guess it's sort of a composite of my lifelong interest in, I'll say fantasy, but I have a whole thing about that we'll probably get into later. But because when you say fantasy, it sort of denotes a genre that I think has completely degenerated into nonsense. So the more precise thing to say here is my interest in Tolkien, and my interest in Tolkien is largely not simply the fantastical elements of his works, but his Anglo-Saxon expertise and his love of that world, combined with my background in philosophy. That's my academic background, you could say. My degrees are in philosophy and theology, ironically, I guess. But I guess The Glorious Path is the culmination of some guy who has had a deep love of Teutonic literature rolling through his brain, whilst at the same time mulling over many philosophical ideas, years worth. It's a philosophical education that's a combination of formal education and autodidacticism on my own part. So I don't know how detailed you want me to get autobiographically here, but...
Well, without giving away any spoilers, maybe you can tell us what is the plot of the book, The Glorious Path, the fictional plot. Well, we'll get into some of the real world themes in it later on.
I don't know how much of the backstory I should give on this, but basically the context presented in the opening part of the work is encapsulated in this idea that the gods have fled, which is borrowed from Martin Heidegger, actually, a German philosopher of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and into the 60s as well. But even that phrase was supposed to be a reworking of Nietzsche's proclamation in Zarathustra that God is dead. And we can talk about that later. But anyway, the main, obviously this is fiction. I mean, The Glorious Path is fiction, but it's a context in which the gods have fled for mysterious reasons. And to explain what those reasons are at this juncture would be to give away some substantial spoilers. But the idea is that humanity has gone its own way for centuries in the absence of these gods who were the de facto rulers of this world. And in the meantime, the various strains of humanity have just filtered out across the continent, and being shorn of their masters have by and large lapsed into decadence and degeneration. And the main character is somebody who just, I guess you could say existentially, is discomfited with that position.
Yeah, Talathastro Maslow, right? Is that how you say it?
Right.
Now, is he based on anyone specific, or is this supposed to represent an archetype in our modern era?
Well, I'm not. I can't remember. You actually have the ARC version, Lana,
mm-hmm.
And you will be getting the finished version, I assure you, any day now, if you wish. But the I can't remember if in the finished version or not it mentions this, but Talathastro was named after a tightrope walker who had come into town that his father had seen and was amused by.
Okay.
So the goofiness of the name is sort of deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
Like I knew the name sounded like a magician or something, or you know, but that is supposed to be reminiscent of part one of Thus Spoke Zarathustra, where there's a tightrope walker, and the name Talathastro has the same sort of syllabic cadence as Zarathustra. So Talathastro is a Zarathustra-esque character throughout this tale. So that's the provenance of the name itself. So it has an extrinsic explanation in terms of its phonetics, but it also has an internal story explanation, which also ties into Zarathustra because of the tightrope walker. So the Glorious Path is filled with these like triangulated metaphors that you don't need to be aware of, but if you do, they're sort of like these Easter eggs that the light bulb goes off. He's like, oh, I got it. I see what he's up to.
Well, you know, this is a theme I've come across a lot too. You know, the gods have fled. And of course, Nietzsche's famous statement, the god is dead. I mean, this is a theme that's really been coming back into the alt-right, if you will. People have talked about this, but both of you guys, what does that mean to say the gods have fled, applying that in modern day? Because I think it does apply in your story, and of course it applies in our modern era. So what does that mean to you?
For me, it's one thing to say, when Nietzsche declares God is dead in Zarathustra, what he is not simply saying is that the Judeo-Christian God does not exist. He's not making a metaphysical assertion, which is how most people seem to interpret that today. Like, I mean, I even heard Richard Dawkins, presumably you know who he is. I mean, yes. who doesn't? But when asked what he thinks about Friedrich Nietzsche in front of an audience, Dawkins' response was, well, I don't know why Nietzsche just didn't say God doesn't exist. Why did he have to say God is dead? That's an ambiguous statement. That you know, which I was sort of following Dawkins up to that for me, that was a sort of turning point where I started deviating from following Dawkins or thinking he had much to say that spoke to me, or, you know, that I had much to derive from what he had to say. But anyway, what Dawkins seems to, like, that sort of thinking, that sort of positivistic, that logical positivistic type thinking doesn't understand that what Nietzsche was doing was providing a sort of super historical commentary on the state of affairs that culture had, especially his European culture. Nietzsche considered himself a European, actually over and above being Prussian. What he was saying was that God, that belief in God has generally been put to the wayside, that we are no longer living in a Christian, like that Christendom itself is over, that, you know, the hold of Christianity over medieval Europe has at last ended, at least among intellectuals or those in power, like Frederick II or somebody like that. And so he saw that as a sign that Europe was entering a new age, a sort of brave new world, if you will, in which the old moral order was no longer to be adhered to.
That's saying a lot more than just God doesn't exist. That's like, that boils down to a point that you might use to, among the intellectuals who were no longer basing their ideas on God being there, that's just like a cursory statement you might say, they might say amongst themselves. But saying God is dead is laying it out as an overall cultural idea, that our culture is no longer based in the idea of, and our human identity is no longer based on an idea of gods or like a longing for or practices related to gods. Even though up to that point, that's what virtually all of humanity, like all of human life and history, had been.
Now, didn't Nietzsche also have a problem, though, with the Western world's reliance on religion, kind of as a moral compass?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, he was, I hope I'm not impressing on you that Nietzsche was necessarily lamenting the fact that God is dead. I mean, one only has to read Antichrist to see that that's not true. Nietzsche's point is that since Christianity finally no longer has the stranglehold on Europe that it had for millennia, we are entering a new era, and it remains to be seen what will come out of that era, because now it's sort of a race to power. Who are going to be the overlords who get to determine what the value shall be for the European races? And so much of his writing is founded on that concern. I don't know how much of this we want to be about Nietzsche, but his ultimate concern was the Superman, or Walter Kaufman translates it as the Overman, for reasons I sort of agree with, because today the Superman, when you say Superman, what do most people think of? A goofy comic book do-gooder created by two Jews in the 1930s.
Yeah,
that's not at all what Nietzsche was talking about. What he had in mind was quite antithetical to that comic book character. So I props to Kaufman for translating it as Zerberman. But yeah, so Nietzsche's basic, well, I'll say basic point, is that in the absence of a God that nobody believes in, and by a God, he means an all, for Nietzsche, the critical thing is an all-powerful being, not an all-moral being. The critical thing is that there's an all-powerful being. And in the absence of a conviction in that being, now man is left to his own devices to eke out an existence without any surety of such a power, and now has a sort of existential burden on his own willing to do something about that. And Nietzsche gives a name for that. He calls it the will to power. The will to power is something that pervades, it's sort of like the Force in Star Wars or something. It's, I don't know, scratch that. That's probably stupid. But it is something that goes down even to, like, if you actually read the book entitled The Will to Power, which he himself didn't publish. It was put together by his sister, who compiled his notes and put it under that title of The Will to Power, which was a book he intended to write, but whether it turned out to be the one his sister published is debatable. But, I mean, even in that work, he describes the will to power as something that reaches all the way down to the protoplasmic level and all the way up to the galactic level, and with human beings just a sort of intermediate expression of the will to power. So when you look at history and you look at sociology and anthropology and you see conflict and racial divides and racial struggles, that's not to be marveled at. That's to be expected, because all groups are engaged ineluctably in a historical and superhistorical will to power.
So is this kind of fits with the might is right concept, doesn't it? I mean, isn't it a question of might versus morality? I mean, today we're really caught up in morality instead of just being mighty and taking what is ours and not feeling guilt about it, right?
Yeah, he has a whole thing about guilt, the bad conscience. For Nietzsche, morality is identified with might. It's not opposed to it. I mean, he defines good as what is strong. Strength is what's good, and what's bad is weakness. So it's not that Nietzsche he does call himself an anti-moralist, but I think that was more for rhetorical purposes than anything else. But he does have an idea of good, and good is whatever is powerful. And the absence of whatever's powerful is bad. And you know, to tie that back into The Glorious Path, since ultimately that's what we're talking about, I guess, that sort of moral rubric is what the prose narrative, the axiological structure, axiology is just this 10-cent word that means the study of values. The axiological structure of The Glorious Path is founded on a sort of political and historical conflict between the slave morality and the master morality. So on the one hand, you have a group of people who represent what you might call the master morality, which is good versus bad, along the lines that I just described as Nietzsche understood that, versus the wider world, which has adopted something that more emphasizes the slave morality, which is good versus evil. Good and evil, in that sense, means the inversion of good and bad, where good is what the master morality would consider as bad, and evil as what the master morality would consider as good, which is strength.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sorry to just add that. It's true when it comes to...
I could ramble.
When it comes to might and morality, it seems like in this day and age, there's a shame for being the strong one, right? And for, or for favoring the victorious or propping up the best one. Now it's the highest road when you can prop up the weakest. It's like the most virtuous thing in the world, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm, you know, I'm not of the millennial generation, as you can probably see by the phrase already coming in here, but it, I mean, even in the 70s and 80s, it was unheard of to boast of being the greatest victim of all. I mean, that's just astonishing to me. I'm not that plugged into the whole internet realm, but to what extent I have seen of it, it's abhorrent. Like, I just can't believe that people are seem to be engaged in a competition as to outdo one another as to who's the greatest victim. I mean, this celebration of weakness, as you're putting it, Lana, well, as you are describing, to me, the ultimate logic of that is nihilism. Or, as Nietzsche says, a death wishing. Because there are no options about it. I mean, either you're ascending in strength, or you are diminishing towards weakness and final eradication. That's the spectrum that all life lives on, whether you like it or not. And the culture we seem to be living in is one that prides itself on hastening towards obliteration, at least in the West, and at least among the descendants of, I'll say, our stronger Teutonic ancestors, who would not have understood the current malaise that we're in presently.
No.
It would have been unthinkable.
No, I mean, what do you guys both think is the main source of European people's tendency in today and age to feel guilt and shame like they do? Where do you guys think that comes from?
It's definitely a fallout from Christianity. But Christianity doesn't have the same hold, especially over the European, as it used to, at least not in the religious supernatural sense. To a large extent, it would seem that, and this is an experience that I've seen and that Seth has seen along with me, in what was called the New Atheist Movement. I'm not sure if that's really a term anymore. It's not really about that anymore, but the sudden departure from following the Christian religion and a slew of people becoming atheists, basically, what they were doing is they were throwing out belief in the God, throwing out supernatural beliefs, basically, which comports with what Seth and I are doing here, because there's not supposed to be anything supernatural in the glorious path. They threw out supernaturalism and God and sublimity, basically, but kept the morality. So in a sense, like the modern atheist, the sort of liberal secular humanist, if you will, is still a Christian. Like to my eyes, really, they hold on to that morality and that guilt. It's just that to them, it's not being commanded or spurred by a God. And I'm sure Seth can tell you he's been privy to having listened to debates and such arguments that secular humanists are now trying to come up with to create a rational basis for their morality, a basis that's built sort of through the combination of studying nature and what they consider to be rationality, such as with the work by Sam Harris titled Good Without God. He's looking for a way to maintain the Christian interpretation of good and bad, right and wrong, without having the religion there, which includes, you know, the rituals and the hierarchy, etc. So Seth, I'm not sure if you have a tie in there as far as like
Well, the rationality.
Or secular humanism, because I know Glorious Path really attacks that, right?
Yeah, I think at that point, my Nietzschean influence probably shines the most, because if there was one thing that Nietzsche was consistent on, it was attacking the supposed necessary connection between morality and an emancipation from God or something like that. I mean, one of Nietzsche's points is that socialism, which centers or founds itself on sort of protecting the oppressed, supposedly, and instilling revenge in those who are oppressed against those who wield power, shares the same provenance with Christianity. And there's obvious historical evidence of this. I mean, the early church was basically communistical in structure, where people were sharing property as they hid from Roman authorities, lest they be persecuted. So it's not to be marveled at that as the 19th century rolled on and jettisoned the metaphysical beliefs of Christianity, it nonetheless inherited the slave, the Slavish moral code of Christianity. And we have to remember, too, that when Nietzsche was attacking Christianity, he was trying to point out an irony that his fellow Prussians, while disdaining Jews, adopted, by and large, Lutheran Christianity. And Nietzsche's point was, well, wait a minute. It's pretty obvious that Christianity itself is an extension of Judaism. So in multiple places, in Ecce Homo, in Antichrist, in the Gay Science, Nietzsche identifies the two great corruptors of the European races as, first off, Christianity, and second place, alcoholism, and third place, syphilis. Which he may have been a victim of himself, who knows, but the basic point, it's sort of a Socratic maneuver on his part to say, look, if you guys are opposed to the if you're opposed to the Semitic influences in Germany, you ought also to be opposed to Christianity, which is the plot per Jews, par excellence, to get Judaism into the souls and minds of Europeans.
Yeah, we're living in cultural Judaism now. We really are. And yeah, it kind of reminds me of also Tom Sunek's work. I know he's picked up from this, where he basically talks about the downfall of the West has been Abrahamic religions and monotheistic thinking and forsaking our pagan polytheistic ways. That if we were to return to that, basically our European identity would be restored if we return to the old ways before Christ.
Right. Nietzsche calls for what he called the new barbarians to emerge. Mm-hmm. Nietzsche's interest was also in the Greco-Roman world. He was a philologist and specialized in ancient Athenian culture and Hellenic culture. So he was interested in a sort of Renaissance-type union of the Greco-Roman cultures of the South and the Teutonic cultures of the North. And in The Glorious Path, I try to furnish a narrative, a story, a fictional story that expresses that union. And that's not only that wasn't the simplest thing to do, because we've only but scarcely seen such hints of that ever. I guess sort of partly in the Italian Renaissance, perhaps. But anyway, the Glorious Path is somewhat an experiment in trying to envision, perhaps for the first time, what that may look like in the peoples of the Morellani. The Glorious Path is book one of what's meant to be a five-book series.
And it's kind of a quasi-ancient world, right? What do you think was better about ancient times in Europe? Obviously, you like it based on what you've written in your book.
Yeah, well, for one thing, there was a clear order of rank. I know this may not sit well with some people, perhaps, but the Glorious Path doesn't exactly celebrate egalitarianism. I mean, it does find merit in an order of rank, a just and fair order of rank, but you know, one that does acknowledge merit and superiority where it exists. We tend to live in a world, as one only needs to look at the education system to see this, that puts the lowest first at the expense of the more advanced students. The higher, the more intelligent students are held back for the sake of.
Yeah, it's all about it becomes the lowest common denominator, right?
Yeah. Well, what does that mean in the long run? I mean, what are we saying our fundamental values are when we do that then? I mean, shouldn't we be celebrating the greatest specimens we have, the highest expressions of merit, and fostering those?
Yes.
Why is everything subordinated to what happens to be the most oppressed or the lowliest? Or and that's why the morality of pity is such a bane on modern society. Pity, you know, to go back to Eric's point that he was talking about, the secular humanists, all this is kind of coherent, even if it seems like we're rambling. To be convinced that there isn't scientific evidence for God, and by the way, when most people say God, they mean some sort of Semitic God. You know, when on the street somebody, or the internet, says that they're an atheist, they probably aren't talking about a disbelief in Odin or Wotan or somebody.
Yeah.
They generally mean a disbelief in Yahweh or some version of it. I was following that crowd for a while, sort of just out of a philosophical interest. But what has happened is that crowd has liberalized tremendously. It's lapsed into a morass of just liberal nihilism to such a disgusting degree. I can barely even watch any internet video or read any book written by any of these guys or anything. I do have a brief anecdote about that if I can share it.
Sure.
I'm not sure how interesting it is or not. But Eric and I have actually attended both Reason rallies, if you know what they are.
No, I don't.
They are these like secular, they're like the Woodstocks of these secular liberal atheists.
Good times. Yeah,
the first one was in 2012, and both took place in D.C. And we went there sort of just as purveyors and tourists, if you will, just to see what it was like.
At the time, I might add, like, part of the context of that was, at the time, we both grew up Catholic. I was still right. Catholic, like sort of on the fence about being Catholic at the time. That's when I was questioning the belief, mostly the supernatural beliefs. And so that's what sparked my interest in some of the thinkers who were in this new atheist movement. And I already knew Seth's philosophical background. And so we kind of coalesced around that event and decided to attend the first Reason rally. At that point, I basically had jettisoned any belief in anything supernatural, essentially. So that's sort of the context that we started with. And of course, the 2016 Reason rally is coincided with finishing up the publishing of Seth's book, The Glorious Path. So that's sort of how the Reason rally ties into this. But Seth, you can continue with your anecdote.
Yeah, well, actually, that's a good point what Eric brought up, because after the experience of the first Reason rally, we just saw a bunch of whiners, basically, who were like complaining about how religious people are domineering in society, and I don't know, they had this victim complex that it just turned my stomach. And what that did was raise the question for Eric and me, well, what are we about then? You know, I mean, okay, are we just going to be a crowd of nihilists that say, ah, oh, nothing matters, there's no God, oh, it's so sad, and let's just wait around and die or something like that. So,
or just turn to like libertine hedonism and yeah. not be about anything and make as your base, like your primary value is setting up a culture where everyone just sates all the pleasures that they might at the drop of a hat be inclined towards, but go no farther than that, have no concern for, say, discretion or aesthetics or how one is living one's passion, aside from that it does not interfere with anyone else's manner of living out his desires. So it basically kind of boiling down into a utilitarian morality, minimizing pain as much as possible and maximizing pleasure as much as possible for as many people as possible.
Well, that's not really being in touch with nature, is it? I mean, you have a whole segment in the end, you know, to question modern truths, and you write something about, you know, what does it mean to love nature? And it also means embracing the pleasure and the suffering, right? And the life and the death. It seems like a lot of liberals, they run from nature, actually. Egalitarianism is anti-nature. It's like it's become a religion, egalitarianism. It's a fantasy.
I would say there's a lot of attempt in the culture at large as it's panned out in the past couple of decades of trying to live against nature, where you're trying so hard to avoid suffering so much that you're building something that's, say, top heavy, considering, for instance, like the way the population has exploded, but being ignorant to that going on indefinitely. That's kind of a whole tangent that we don't necessarily have to get into. I think we also dropped off at one of Seth's points, bringing up the Reason Rally.
Well, yeah, I guess, right. That was like heading up towards an anecdote. I guess I'll complete that. But we went to the second Reason Rally, which was in June of 2016. We had a booth set up where we were peddling the Glorious Path, if you will. And it was at an after party for the Reason Rally, you know, filled with a bunch of half inebriated liberals selling books with quite different themes. And I actually sold a copy of the book to Dan Barker. I don't know if you know who he is or
not. Sounds familiar, but I can't remember. Is it a singer?
No, he's the co-founder of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, but located in Madison, Wisconsin. So he's like this watchdog. He's got a team of lawyers that take complaints from people who feel that there's been a state religion violation. So he's a pretty big deal. I mean, but he came up to me sort of tepidly. Seeing the banner, we had the banner hanging behind us that said the gods have fled. One man finally does something about it, sort of a catchphrase. And this took at least half a testicle to hang up, sort of in the lion's den of these atheists to promulgate that sort of message.
Yeah, most of the people in this crowd were. Not only do they not believe in gods, but the very idea of a god, even if it were, say, something plausible, naturalistically, they're opposed to. So that's sort of what we were walking into, declaring an idea about gods that was not meant to be supernatural, which should not upset their sensibilities as far as like what they think can be true, but they were still uncomfortable with it. And, you know, there's the question of why, but nevertheless, that was the context that, you know, that we were walking into, that Seth's anecdote, where Seth's anecdote picks up.
Now, I would think, too, in a crowd like that, that they would see this book, if they were to read it and hear about, you know, return of the Ubermensch, that they would say, oh, well, this is quite fascist and racist, right? You want Europeans to become great again, right? And even saying that is like, you're a fascist Nazi.
Right. We were pretty sure we heard this pink-haired liberal mutter under her breath that we're scary right-wingers. I had never even... There was nothing about our table that proclaimed our political stature at all, but she somehow inferred that. But Dan Barker came up to the table sort of cautiously and said, now, I will buy a copy, but please assure me first whether this is free thinking in spirit. And as a sort of inside joke, I guess, I said, oh, yes, but it's very free thinking, which was an echo of in the Gay Science, Nietzsche calls himself, like, what he's about is a very free spirit, as opposed to the sort of mediocre free spirits of socialists. But anyway, that I guess nobody under, he certainly didn't get that joke, but he did buy a copy, and I've been waiting with bated breath to see what sort of response that this book will elicit from him. I guess even bad publicity is good publicity in this context, but but the worst thing he can do is ignore it. But
I mean, this might be a cheesy question, but you know, how do we set ourselves onto the glorious path or become the Ubermensch? Is that something that you can teach people, or is that something that they need to find on their own? I mean, this is important.
Yeah. I think you'll enjoy part two of the book, Lana, if you ever do have the time. And I say that unironically, like, I totally understand how busy you are. I don't even know if I were in your position, whether I would ever have bothered with a guy like me, you know, reading any of his book. But so thank you for that from the outset. But if you do get that far into the book, I at least in a fictional context, try to relate the answer to that very question you ask. Talathastro is sort of haranguing a crowd, if you will. It's the first time he's made a public appearance of that sort, and he is laying forth what for him is the path for rebuilding what would become the gods, or the Ubermensch, as you mentioned. And he is met with some resistance and some sort of Socratic questioning. And he deals with that. I guess I'll leave it to readers whether he deals with it satisfactorily or not. But I guess I won't shy away from at least a sort of abstract spoiler, at least just for the sake of maybe priming the pump of attracting interest in the book among those who may attach themselves to what's called the alt-right crowd or not, who aren't remiss to this idea. But it does involve a eugenics theme, which you may have picked up on already in chapter 2.
Definitely didn't scare me away.
But I deal, the whole issue of eugenics isn't a whimsical thing for me. I mean, definitely Nietzsche hints at it. I mean, hit the last part of The Will to Power, the entire subsection is entitled Breeding and Discipline. And it goes on at length about what that may mean. But, you know, like I said, my background is in philosophy, and earlier in this interview, when you asked me what The Glorious Path is about, one way of answering that question is this philosophical argumentative side of it. And what I had done was, as with Nietzsche, I've always been fascinated with ethical questions, actually, like what they mean and what sorts of judgments do we employ when we decide, yes, we can go through with this course of action, or no, we must forbid this course of action. But regarding eugenics, what I had done was I looked up, I researched what the best objections to eugenics in the abstract were, and I found them wanting. And so what I did was I created a fictional circumstance, if you will, embedded in an epic narrative mythos that furnishes defeaters for the liberal obfuscations to eugenics. I into this plot, I posit circumstances that defeat these arguments. Like, so what, in other words, what would somebody who opposes eugenics, if they were living in this fictional context, what would their best arguments be now? I mean, you haven't got to the point, but in the book, but when you get to the point where the gate to the Paladok is introduced, and you and the Morilani as a people, as a race, are interpolated into the plot, that's when the sort of fictional defeaters to the best objections to eugenics that I could find are introduced.
Do you want to share what one of those is?
I've
yet to hear a good reason against it.
It always comes down to pity mongering.
Yeah.
I mean, that's always the thing. I mean, that's the God of today. If we want to cut to the chase, we can say, well, no, God isn't that, because God is pity. I mean, that's what is the driving criterion for almost all policy making today.
Yeah, all of society has to stop for the guy in the wheelchair now. You know, I mean, it's the truth.
I mean, and you know, from a noble perspective, you know, Nietzsche talks about nobility, of the noblesse. Our society, like what Marxism has done, is that its highest ideal is to level power and to make everybody the famous Marxist slogan is to afflict the oppressed and to oppress the afflicted. Well, think about that for a second. That's non-dialogue.
Right, to afflict the comforted and comfort the
comforted.
Afflicted.
That's what it was.
Right,
to afflict the comforted and to comfort the afflicted.
Yeah, and to Marxist, the bad guy is the great ones, the ones that have made it, the mighty ones, the beautiful ones, the intelligent ones. They're all about tearing that down.
Yeah, and that is a common theme. Once you pinpoint that pattern, it makes sense of almost everything else you see unfolding around us today, because you see that is the driving instinct. It's a decadent instinct that informs all the decision making that we see going on around us, and it passes for common sense. So, I mean, I guess The Glorious Path is sort of a cheeky project, because it is objecting to a criterion that has been so deeply embedded, unfortunately, even in European races, that it seems like reason itself, you know. And that's the point that Eric was bringing up about the Reason Rally and all these secular humanists. They pretend that their slave morality is the rational response to a godless world.
So how do we break that? Because that is really just infected all of our European nations. How do we break this? That is the question. God of pity, you know.
Well, I'm doing what I can.
I really do think that reading The Glorious Path is a way to start breaking it.
Yeah, I think it's a culture war, and we need a mythos. We pretty much lack that. I mean, the best we can do is look back on the pagan times and sort of surmise what their societies were like, and sort of pantomime what those guys were doing. But I think we need, rather than simply going back and trying to recover some former, like trying to reboot the system back 1400 years or something like that, I think we need to move ahead with things as they are. And I think that it's going to be a culture war, in addition to a political war. Like, obviously, the immigration thing, that has to be taken control of by those in power. No. I mean, I'm assuming all of that. What I'm saying is that let's assume that the European nations have got their shit together, as it were, and have recovered some sort of identity for themselves. Now what? Now we need to recover a mythos, but one that needs to incorporate scientific understanding as it has been for, you know, since the scientific revolution. We can't act as if that hasn't happened. So that's been my thinking. That's sort of the modus operandi that went into the Glorious Path. It's a mythology. That's what it means to say that it's a mythology for the modern age.
Yeah, you've taken the classic archetype of a hero and you've basically updated it to be appropriate for this era with all the things that we're battling, as opposed to in the ancient world, because they battled different things in that time.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, so it is sort of a fable. I mean, I am reluctant to make it an allegory. Like, I don't want to say Nag Faloth stands for any particular nation in today's world, but I wrote it to be, in that sense, vague enough to be applicable to whatever source of degeneration that you see in the world today that is such a bane to Europe's goals.
Now, if Nietzsche were alive today and he was seeing this leftist, puritanical kind of morality police that we see now, how do you think he would combat it? What would he do? What would he tell us to do? What advice would he have? I know,
well,
it's a difficult
first
one.
First off, I think he would be utterly shocked.
If he lives past the heart attack that he gets.
Yeah, right.
When he sees it.
Right, he actually, I think it was in Ecce Homo, he said he had pretty much thrown his hands up into the air almost in a defeatist manner and said that there's no more hope, except perhaps for Russia, he said. So actually, Lana, that might be flattering for you.
Interesting.
He said there may be still hope for the Ubermensch in Russia. Of course, this was written about 20 years, well, like 25 years before the First Great War. He probably did not, I mean, his works did not take off in his lifetime. So he thought, by and large, his message was going unheard. But by, you know, by the time of the First World War, every GI German trooper had two books in his pack. One was a copy of the Lutheran Bible, and the other was a copy of Zarathustra, ironically. I don't think he ever would have predicted that. Nor that in the era between the great wars, that there was in Europe a relatively widespread yearning for the Ubermen. I mean, his idea actually took root for a while in the fascist regimes in Spain, Italy, Croatia, Hungary, Germany, obviously. There actually was, it was almost happening. And then the triumph of Sovietism conjoined with the powers of liberal capitalism overthrew that and have squelched the Ubermen. No one even, I mean, it really did. It just doused those flames. And I guess it may be hubris on my part, but I feel like, it, you know, if I can leave this earth having reinvigorated that yearning for the Ubermen, I feel like I would have done something meaningful. So that, I guess that sort of addresses your question, what we can do about it.
Yeah, it seems that society and people, it's a death wish. Because once you destroy the noble or tear down the great, where are we heading, right?
Right.
It seems like that would be the end. We'd be heading into dark times, into, you know, chaos and violence and third world standards.
Right, just a malaise of ignominy and no expression of sublimity anywhere in cultural forms. So that, but to answer that question, yeah, what can we do about it? I think starting with literature, starting with language, Seth has treated virtually every idea, practically every idea that you can think of that's prevalent in today's culture, and countered it with an inverse instinct. And Talithastro, being a philosophical character, a character whose essence and constitution is made by philosophical inquiry, it counters the degenerate instinct with arguments and passions, because rationality only goes so far. Passions come into it as well. You sort of have to be impassioned towards the ideal of the overman and the sublime world that the bringing forth of the overman would mean, a Wagnerian Teutonic world, if you will. So that's a start.
I'm actually encouraged because in the alt-right movement, a lot of us are talking like this, you know, about becoming great as possible as you can in your own life, right? That's the goal, to break through all those weaknesses that you have and achieving the best that you can be. I mean, that is, to me, striving for the stars. That is the European way, right? We don't sit around and complain, and we don't act like victims. We find a way to get it done, and we strive to be on the path of the hero, right?
Yeah. There is a nuance, though, that I would be remiss not to mention at this point, though, that I totally feel what you're saying, Alana. I mean, that what you're describing is sort of like the Rocky story, like getting stronger now, you know?
Yeah.
I was a Stallone fanatic as a child, so yeah. But I can't tell you how many times I watched all the Rocky movies. I was in boxing myself for years, so. But this is where my political ideas may differ from many those who call themselves of the alt-right. It has to go beyond the individual level, though. It's not just about improving, you know, from the individual's birth to death, becoming is. It's not a solo mission. It has to be a people's goal. It has to be. I mean, I'm refraining from using the word collectivist because that sounds socialistic, and I can assure you I don't have a Marxist bone in my body.
No, I get it. It has to be a tribal thing, you know?
Yeah.
We have to be tribally united, like a tribal kind of hive mind, to be able to get to the goal here.
Yeah, there does have to be some individual sacrifice in order to attain a super historical achievement. And I feel like that's why the label alt-right is a little bit unfortunate in a way, because it's somewhat euphemistic in that it allows people to call themselves that.
And we've seen that happening too. Just random people picking it up now that are libertarians, for instance. So,
You took the word right out of my lips here. Right. I mean, I consider these people confused libertarians.
Yeah.
I don't know why they just don't consider themselves right wing. They're leaving the alt part out of the equation. My recommendation, well, I actually, I don't know if it is my recommendation for strategic reasons, but logically, if that's the way to put it, I would just cut to the chase and say you're fascist. And using that term is politically incorrect enough to screen out dunderheads like Milo Yiannopoulos,
mm-hmm.
who are okay with calling themselves alt-right, but he wouldn't at all publicly associate with fascism.
No.
It would screen out buffoons like that.
That's true. Absolutely.
But I don't necessarily recommend, perhaps, I just as a matter of strategy, just sheer Machiavellian strategy at this point, I don't know if I would recommend switching the alt-right label to totalitarianism or fascism, because it may be at too tender of a stage.
There are lots of people in the alt-right that identify as fascists, and the funny thing is that the enemy calls us all fascists anyway. And when you look at, you know, there really needs to be, and I've been looking for someone to address this, to do a good show on what fascism actually is, the political system, the social system. I haven't been able to find anyone on point who can really discuss this. But I mean, fascism obviously is something that scares the globalist elite more than anything on the planet. So therefore, we should really be looking into it.
Yeah. I mean, if you have any positive goals for anything other than just leveling power, that's going to take the form of something that they will call fascism. Look, I mean, I've heard people, to go back to the secular liberal atheist thing again, I've actually heard people say, what are we to do about atheists who have joined the alt-right movement? Because they're scary. Say that's the only objection I've heard, if you want to call it that, to membership in that community of the alt-right. Oh, well, you guys are scary. That's the mantra I hear over and over again. Well, from my point of view, I take pride in being on the scary side. That's hilarious. I mean, what that I'm supposed to be insulted by that? It's not a disproof of anything. It's not a Socratic disproof. You're just expressing your decadent values. And even when you are the majority, you actually have the greater power. You guys ought to be the scary ones. But you're calling this minority group the scary ones?
Yeah, they're really
there's
terrified
something
to
be said for that.
Yeah. You know, going back to Milo, he actually thinks that SJWs are fascists.
Look, that you're right. That there's a horrible need to clarify what this word fascism means. It has come to mean, it's too subjective. It just means whatever serves as a cause for some sort of ill feeling in somebody.
Yeah.
That's not enough. I mean, it goes back to the Etruscan fascis with the bundle of sticks gathered around an axe head, which was supposed to symbolize a people galvanized around a speaker, that is a dictator, dicere in Latin, to speak, one who speaks, the dictator. So a people gathered around a speaker, a dictator, who has a matter of life and death in his hands. That's what the axe means. It means he can dole out judgments that affect matters of life and death. And there's nothing more fundamental than that. It has specific political ramifications that are just missed out on when you have guys like Milo, I guess he pronounces his name, as just whatever is scary or deplorable in society. That's ridiculous. That has no historical grounding whatsoever.
Oh, I agree completely. And fascism, though, I mean, it is a newer political system. And from what I can tell, it seems to have arisen in a dire time when they need to be a fist to combat the enemy, right?
Yeah, I mean, it rose up pretty much after the First World War, particularly among the Italians, as a response to what to do to, you know, the windfall and the widespread destruction of Europe and the disintegration of the old monarchies and houses of nobility. Three primary schools of thought arose to deal with the problem: fascism, Sovietism, and liberalism, basically. And we know which one lost out in that conflict.
Now, Eric, I wanted to ask you a question because we had a kind of an interesting exchange over emails, and we were talking about, you know, might versus morality and what is good and, you know, what is just. So what do you think about, you know, is there such a thing as justice? And I'll open that up to you, Seth, as well. And us, like, wanting justice?
Yeah, it depends on the context in which you're asking that. Justice has come to mean an expression of vengeance to a large extent. Vengeance for some injury that has taken place. That's pretty much what our modern court system is built around. So satisfying the bloodlust of, say, someone who's received harm, or honestly, the not fulfilling a debt. You would consider the punishment doled out by the justice system to be the fulfillment of that debt. But justice, as far as having a goal, it could come to mean something slightly different, because justice, the word, has a similar root to justification. And with a goal, what one does within the auspices of having a goal, say a society that has a goal, in the case that we're talking about, the bringing forth the Overman, justification in action would have to pertain to those deeds which affect the furthering of that goal. I suppose I'm getting at an answer to your question here.
Yeah, because we were talking about acting in vengeance, you know. I mean, that's something that basically the tribal elite are doing, right? So we don't want to behave like them.
Well, in a sense, right. I remember the conversation we had, actually. It was, are we going to base our future actions on simply trying to rectify injuries that have been done to, say, our own, our kin, or even members of our race? You know, and are you going to start building up, are you going to build your identity about around reacting to an attack? Or are you going to set up a goal, a task, and deal with attacks as they come, but nevertheless, your identity is not built around or in reaction to what your adversary is.
Exactly.
I'm saying this mainly because of, like, the alt-right obsession with the Jews. It becomes beyond an obsession, really. It can reach the point where, to be what you are, you need that adversary.
Sure. Yeah, I get that.
Well, the goal of the Overman is complete. It's indifferent to whatever Judaism is. Now, Nietzsche does talk about Christianity and brings up aspects of Judaism because it's the most prevalent cultural inversion of his idea. But there comes a time to just move past that. Once you've crystallized what the task is, what the goal is.
So both of you guys thinking in terms of what we're dealing with, if you do believe that there is a tribal elite actively working against us, what do we do? how do we move forward?
I really start with language again and spreading, bringing people into the instincts that in this case have been expressed in The Glorious Path. They're also expressed in Nietzsche. And really rekindling those instincts for the task of the Overman. Seth, do you have anything to add to that? Perhaps to answer a way of answering that
question?
Yeah,
it may be a bit harsher of a tone than what you're saying. I mean, I totally agree with you. I mean, we need a culture, and language, as Heidegger points out, is the backbone of that. We need to language is in just the most ignominious state it's ever been in, partly because literacy has been attempted to be universalized. But look, we can't avoid war. I mean, the fascistic state is a warring one. Yeah. We can't think of war as something avoidable or something foreign to the nature of existence or something like that. Peace. Peace is a good thing, but when it's the side effect of victory. So, and there is no victory without war. despite what Gandhi may have said. I mean, we do have to wage wars to make this happen. I think ultimately, if we don't graduate into a state of being on the aggressive and not merely defending ourselves, then it will be over for the European races and the whole Teutonic and Greco-Roman legacies. That, as hard as it is to believe, the modern white liberal is the inheritor of. I don't know if it's going to happen or not. The whole warring spirit of the Teutonic and Celtic races seems to have been so bred out of through domesticization, that the European races, it seems like a lost cause. But I'm just saying, it seems like a necessary condition, at the least, that wars actually will have to be waged to resist the elitism that you're mentioning.
I agree.
It's not enough to just mount defenses. You actually have to be active, not just reactive. Will that ever happen? I don't know, but you know, Eric's language, he was talking about having a goal, and that ties in with what I was saying during the Great Wars. There was a yearning for the Overman. I think if we could recover that Hellenic and Teutonic love for what's higher and refashion society from the ground up, practically galvanized around that valuation, and then wage wars on its behalf, wars whose stake is the advent of the Overman, then we could be in for a glorious age. But as long as we're simply acting on the defense, I think it'll be just a matter of time before Celtic and Germanic, the remnants of Celtic and Germanic tribes are finally obliterated.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a sad truth. We have to be more on the offense rather than the defensive, and it's going to take some organization. But I do feel that fire rising. You know, it's definitely there. It's starting to come together.
Yeah, I don't want to sound all pessimistic here. I wrote The Glorious... It took me 4 years to write this book, and I was writing... being a hermit is sort of a theme in that book. Telethaster is described over... Well, once you get to chapter 7, you'll see what I'm talking about, but he basically lives on and in a mountain, a distant mountain, for years by himself.
Well, that's you, right?
There is a little bit of autobiography built into this, but I was living for weeks at a time without any human contact in Kentucky and then in Virginia as I wrote this. So I do have a bit of firsthand existential experience of Nietzsche's hermitage. But I wrote this honestly wondering who the hell is going to read this book. You know, it just seems so personal. I thought let alone God is dead. I thought Nietzsche was dead. You know, I thought everything about the ideas that he was espousing were just completely wiped off the face of the earth, save in philosophy 101 courses or something. But near the end of its construction, I slowly learned of this phenomenon of, you know, what's been branded as the alt-right so far, at least. And I honestly shocked. Like, I sort of couldn't believe that there were other people out there expressing, at least in their own way and to whatever extent they could, values that to a large extent seem to harmonize with what this book is about. So it's a weird serendipity that I definitely didn't plan for, and I'm not a huckster trying to come in after the fact and cash in on this.
Well, we welcome you to the family. We need people. We need people of all talents. Yes, we do. You know, a language, exactly. Language is huge. So I wanted to ask you last question here. You know, we can't call things by their name anymore, right? You can't say what is in front of your face anymore, according to this leftist totalitarianism. You can't notice things anymore, according to this system right now. So how do we tackle censorship?
Do you mean we can't because of...
Well, society, people ice people out, you know, if they have certain views or call things by their name. I mean, even saying that, like, race exists or gender constructs, you know, exist, right?
Well, I mean, save for having Facebook profiles shut down and things like that, it seems like you can do those things. It just means you have to have developed a thicker skin to develop, you know, to withstand the sociological fallback for doing that. Yeah, I guess it actually could reach the point theoretically where anyone who doesn't explicitly represent liberal viewpoints won't even have any place at the table the rubric of freedom of speech. So for now, our friend is freedom of speech, even though that itself is a liberal idea, which liberals try to pull a Socratic maneuver on fascists for saying, well, but wait a minute, you don't believe in freedom of speech, but you're making use of it, to which I say I'll exploit whatever means I can, as long as you're giving it to me. But so for now, that hasn't happened. So as long as you're okay with being called a Nazi or whatever, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. Like, who cares? It's a word.
Just keep marching on and have a thicker skin about it.
We're in the day and age when people care about words. Like, being called a racist makes people's whole world and life crumble. I mean, how weak and pathetic, you know?
Yeah, what can they do to you? I mean, race exists, whether these people have a problem with it or not. I don't know. Let it be water shedding off your skin.
Yeah.
And keep pressing forward.
I think that would go along with, you know, the glorious path of being confident and strong and just basically charging forward and just not giving a damn. I mean, we need more of those kinds of people to change the culture of things, to make it socially acceptable to be a certain way again.
No? And it has to be uncompromising. You have to have a sort of captain's morality about your ship. You have to be willing to go down with it.
Yeah. Any last things you guys want to add before we round up for this time?
Well, Eric, do you want to explain how people can get the book? I'm horrible at the salesmanship of this book.
Yeah, we have the hardback available on airstoreworks.com. We'll share that link with you. I'm sure you'll be able to find it on the Red Ice page as well, but it's airstroworks.com. And right now, if you pick up a copy of the hardback, you'll be able to get the ebook for free as well. Some people like to read the digital copy while they have a hard copy, you know, for their collection. And currently the paperback is in a pre-order status. So, and we also have a Facebook page for the book, and we're just getting started putting updates on there as well. So, but it's, you know, we're directing everyone to our website to actually get a copy.
That's right. And I encourage everyone to pick up a copy. It's important that we support each other that are doing good work, whether it's arts or politics or things that they're making. It's very important to support our own, right, guys?
Yeah, I can at least be confident in saying it will hopefully be a good read as well. I mean,
yes,
isn't all just abstract ideology. I did try to put together a damn good story on top of it all, and I agonized over every letter and every phraseology.
Well, thank you guys. Let's definitely do this again sometime, okay?
Yeah, will do. Thank you very much once again.
Thank you for having us.
I always find this kind of conversation inspiring. If you want to become the Overman, I think you must surround yourself by others who want that too. Those relationships can be a catalyst and a motivator. The best antidote to our diseased society and culture of pity is to become the greatest and strive to be the strongest you can be in every facet of your life. Never settle for who or what you are right at this moment, but always strive for more. Never be a victim but a hero. Never ask permission or seek acceptance. Set new standards and forge a new path. Before I let you go, remember to tune into our live coverage of the final presidential debate tomorrow, Wednesday the 19th, starting at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time with special guests. We'll be counting score live, literally, during the debate. It'll be a fun night, so don't miss it. Head over to redice.tv or our Red Ice YouTube channel to watch live. Love you all. See you next week.